My name is Roland. I'm an addict. And I want to say that it's a pleasure to be here, to hang out with you guys and come and have breakfast with you. I was just talking to Bobby, and he was reminding me that I was at a convention that you had in Visalia in 2000, in the year 2000, and did the men's meeting there. And I thought it was a long time ago. It feels like a lot longer than that. But anyway, I'm glad to be here. I like coming through this part of the country, the state. I mean, I don't like staying here for too long, but I do like coming, passing through it. You know, I'm so glad to be clean, man. You know, my home group was a men's meeting in San Jose for a number of years, a Monday night men's meeting in San Jose where I went for probably about 10 years straight until I relocated. And I actually prefer to be around addicts, and I prefer to be around addict men. And that's my choice. And I remember for many years I had a hard time hanging out with you know, kind of using men in that way. You know, women raised me. You know, I didn't have a father. If my father walked into this room right now, I wouldn't even know him. I had two kind of stepfather guys that never really was very helpful. Matter of fact, they was pretty hurtful. And I grew up in a way that I went to women for what I needed. I had a mom and a sister, and women always took care of me, and I had, you know, it took me a long time to figure out the value, the therapeutic value of one addict helping another, but truly the therapeutic value of developing some relationships with some men in this program. And today, I have a group of men that I talk to about everything. We get together and we hang out and we go to movies and we do stuff. We shoot pool and we talk shit and we do all the stuff that men do together. And, you know, when I first got clean, the women kept me coming back. You know, when I first got to Narcotics Anonymous, man, it was the women. They said, come here and find somebody who's got something you want. And I said, she got something I want, she got something I want, she got something I want. They said, get some phone numbers and use them. I said, can I get that phone number? Can I get that phone number? I'm going to use it. You know. They said, you keep what you have by giving it away. So I was trying to give it away to everyone that would take it. Baby, can I give you some of this? Can I give you some of this? And, you know, I went to all the dances. And, you know, when I found out, you know, what was the trip? Because when I was using, I didn't work. I wasn't no working addict. I didn't have no job. My job was I lived to use and used to live. And all the women in my life were hookers, and I didn't care much about sex. And I thought that anybody that really needed to have sex was a trick, was a sucker. And so I could take or leave sex. And I would have women all over, and I would want to have sex if it was something strange. You know, if it was something kind of freakish, I might want to do it, you know, or... if I had a choice between having sex and shooting a speedball, I'm shooting a speedball. Fuck the sex. I might say, well, baby, wait a minute, we don't have sex in a minute. I'm going to be right back. And I go in the bathroom and do my thing. And about 3 hours later, I might come out the bathroom ready to do something. And if she's still there, I might do something, and, you know. So I really wasn't no big sex guy when I was using. I was a using guy. I didn't care. That occupied all of my time, you know, finding ways and means to use and you know, trying to get drugs, using the drugs, and recovering from using the drugs. I mean, that was all what I was about. And so when I got clean, I remember the first time a girl gave me a hug in the program. You know, I was in a meeting, and a girl walked up to me and gave me a hug, and I thought, damn, this shit feels good. And I didn't want to let her go. She was, you know, when people pass you, like, I'm done hugging now. Pass me. I'm, like, holding. And so, you know, and I got it. My body woke up. You know, interesting thing happened. My body woke up. And I say this, I didn't intend to talk about this, but I think it's worth talking about, this being a men's meeting and all, because there's a couple of things that we don't really talk about enough that we probably ought to talk about. My experience in recovery is that people get loaded over the shit they ain't talking about. You know, you hear people getting come back after a relapse, and you ask them, man, what happened? And they start telling you about some shit they was doing that they wasn't telling nobody about. And you see them get at the meetings raising their hand wanting to share all the time, you know, or talking to people out there smoking cigarettes, and they talking. Ain't like they ain't talking, but they ain't talking about the stuff they need to be talking about. And so my experience is that this sex thing is one of the things that people ain't talking about. And we as men, it's one of the quickest ways that we wind up compromising our values and our principles and our integrity in recovery. You know, so, you know, I get clean and my body wakes up and I wind up screwing. You know, I think men walk around in recovery early on with our penis in one hand and our umbilical cord in the other hand. And we trying to connect. You know, we looking for some place to plug one of them things in, you know. And you know, the girl hugged me. The girl licked my nipple. One day a girl licked my nipple. And I grabbed that bitch head. I was like, man, what she got in her mouth, man? What was, because I had never felt nothing like that. You know, my whole body kind of, I'm going to do that again. And it was on. It was on from there, you know. So I ran amok in NA. I was a tramp in the program. You know, I ran around and I screwed everybody that would give me some. I remember one day being in the meeting and looking around the meeting and realizing there was about three girls in the meeting that I had sex with and that I had been lying to. I had all this kind of secret stuff going on in the meeting. And it's a kind of funky feeling to feel shady in a meeting. I don't know if anybody ever had that experience where you feel shady in the meeting, you know. And so, you know, I found out the hard way that the women kept me coming back, but the men kept me from going out. So I realized I couldn't get what I really needed from the women, because like everything, you know, it runs its course. And I would go around and the sex, you know, recovery's not sexually transmitted. And, you know, and I tried to get it like that, but there's a whole lot of other stuff that's sexually transmitted. You know, and I tell you that these girls in recovery, these recovery girls, and our NA girls are hotter than the other fellowships. You know, NA girls are hot. You know, because they all freaks. You know, they most of them are all recovering freaks. They're recovering hookers, recovering strippers, recovering just closet freaks. And you know, that it was the men that kept me from going out, though, because it runs its course, and you get to the point where you realize that just because they washed up, and just because they got perfume on, and just because they done got a little weight on now and got some teeth, and, you know, we start thinking, yeah, she's all that, but everybody in the rooms ain't clean. And so you're liable to wind up with all kind of stuff. You know, I wound up getting chlamydia. I didn't even know what chlamydia was. I had never heard of chlamydia. Well, I don't get yeast infections. I didn't even know men could get yeast infections. You know, so you got to be careful. Somebody needs to hear that right now. You got to be careful out there, and you ain't going to get, the woman ain't going to give you the recovery. It's okay to have fun. It's okay to have sex, you know, but you, when you get to lying and cheating and sneaking, when you get to obsessing about it, when you get to doing it despite known negative consequences, when you start having physical and financial problems as a result of it, when you feel like your integrity is compromised in your pursuit of it, something's wrong. You know, and when I got clean in June 10th, 1986, I went through treatment in handcuffs from jail. I was using in jail. I had never thought that I could get clean. You know, I'm looking around the room and I'm seeing some outlaws in here. Y'all, some outlaws. No question about it. We got some guys in this room right now that the world is a better place because you're clean. You know, right? There's a whole lot of people that are a lot better off because you're clean. And a lot of society had checked us off and put the check mark next to our name and said, this one right here is no good. We was the kind of kids that parents didn't want you to come over to their house. Like, don't bring that kid over to the house no more. You know, that little curly-haired kid, that little kid right, that little crazy one right there, don't bring him over here no more. We was the kind of kids that parents didn't want their kids hanging out with. That they didn't want their girls dating. Oh, no, not that one. We call up on the phone, the parents see us and say, oh, no, hell no. You know. And then we got caught up in the criminal justice system, and we got caught up in whatever it was that we was doing, and a lot of us ain't supposed to be here right now. A lot of us in this room, we're alive in spite of ourselves. We're on the streets in spite of ourselves instead of the penitentiary. We're eating breakfast instead of in some hospital ward for some life-threatening disease in spite of ourselves, you know. And so we got another chance. I never thought I was going to be clean. Never, ever. I didn't know guys like me got clean. I came from Chicago. I grew up in Chicago. I moved from Chicago to California, lived in San Francisco for 10, 12 years, and my addiction ran amok. I started shooting dope when I was 16, in the military, underage, in Europe, in Amsterdam, one weekend, stuck a needle in my arm, shot some heroin, and loved it. And it was on. That was it. All that scary stuff that I used to have as a kid, all that little insecurity, all of that stuff that we had, that I had struggled with when I was growing up, the first time that I fixed, all that was gone. I had zero insecurity. I had zero concern about what you thought about me. I had zero fear. I had found it. And from the time I was 16 until I got clean when I was 29, I used. And in the process, I never ever thought that I would not use. You know, for the first 5 years of my using, I loved being an addict. All that stuff about your worst day in recovery is better than your best day using, that's some cool, clever shit to say at a meeting. But that wasn't the case for me, you know. I had a ball using, you know, and I've had some miserable days clean. I've had some days clean where it felt like my heart was being ripped out of my chest. I had some days clean that I felt so overwhelmed with how hard it was to do the next right thing that I would have traded that to be able to shoot a speedball. You gonna tell me that that's better than that? That's not the case for me. The only reason that I don't use is because I ain't willing to pick up the tab. And I didn't stop using because using didn't feel good or using wasn't fun. I stopped using because the price got too high. The price got too high. We can't be lying to ourselves and act like, oh, I don't like using them. You know, using was all messed up. Using was cool. If it wouldn't have been cool, you wouldn't have did it for as long as you did it. You didn't stop doing it because it wasn't cool. You stopped doing it because the price got too high. Because it got harder to continue to use than the idea of stopping. But if my thought is that if any one of us, and by the way, the fact that we're able to even be here right now is grace. It is a blessing. It's by grace that your mind is open enough to be receptive to being at a meeting and being part of a home group and being part of a fellowship, because a whole lot of people that really need to be here, they can't get it. They ain't feeling it. You know, and a lot of people are still caught, you know, the part of using that was one of the things that made you, that was part of that using being so good, was that obsession that went with that, was that obsession to do it again. I remember that feeling, I want to do it again. I remember that feeling, I want to do it again. Just like when that girl did that, I said, do it again. Anything that feels good to us, we say, do it again. If some of y'all, I saw you get a plate, said, damn, that was good, I'm going to do it again. And went back up there and got another plate. You know, and some of us, we can't never give, you know, remember being on a mission? Anybody ever been on a mission? Now, I'm looking around the room. I know there's some brothers in here that's been on a mission. I can look at y'all and tell, yeah, this guy's been on a mission. He's been on a mission is like when you know that you're going to use today. No matter what. No matter what. I'm broke. I done beat everybody in town. The dope man trying to kill me because I run off with a package. I ain't got no veins. I'm on parole. I ain't reported. I'm dirty. My girl mad at me. The rent's due. All those reasons don't matter when you're on a mission. See, when you're on a mission, you're going to get high no matter what. And sometimes that overwhelming obsession to use, you know, that's an obsession to use that'll kick your ass out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, get up, punk. We finna get high. What you doing sleeping? Get your ass up. Go get some money. We finna get high today. And you just walk in the streets at 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock, looking to hit a lick. You know, somebody, I'm going to find somebody that needs something. And you're kicking cans and looking under bushes for like somebody grabbing some dope under the bushes. You know, maybe somebody left a package down there, you know. And remember that? If any one of us was struck with that today, we'd be using. See, that's the grace. That all the steps you're doing and all the meetings you're going to and all the stuff, I know a whole lot of people that are dead now because they never got relieved of that obsession to use. You can't really take a whole lot of credit for being relieved of that. You know, something, that's that higher power thing moving in your life that takes that out of you just for long enough for you to be receptive for this message. Not my message, but the message of recovery. That it be in your mind and your heart that's opened up to the idea that maybe I can be clean. Because a lot of us don't ever believe that. Don't even get that for a long time. And if we were dealing every day with that obsession, I gotta use, and you know people like that. They can't sit in a meeting longer than a month before that obsession snatches their ass right out the meeting. So come on back here. So if that hasn't happened for you, you know, be grateful. Thank your higher power, you know, for giving you that. Because that's a gift. So, yeah, I didn't think I could get clean. You know, I came into treatment in handcuffs. Used the first 5 years. It was a party. I had big fun using. I got track marks. I was proud of my track marks. You know, that's sad. We got Friday track marks. You know, I had one right here that I could do without even tying up. I could just right in there. Didn't even need to tie it off. And I was like proud of that. Those of you who didn't use IV drugs, it's like to have your favorite pipe or something. You know, I had like my favorite vein pop, and that was it. You know, and you know, and it was. I was proud to be a heroin addict. Our first step is so cool. Me and this brother were talking about, you know, we talk a lot in the meetings about, you know, what we use and how much we use. You know, when they say we don't care what you use, how much you use, or who your connections were. But for a lot of us in the beginning, we can't talk about that. We ain't got nothing else to talk about. Because we ain't really got no whole bunch of other stuff to talk about. All of our identity is tied up into what we use, how much we use, and who our connections were. So when if you say we don't want to hear about that or we don't care about that, we got to think of some new shit to talk about. So our first step says we admitted we were powerless over our addiction. See, it don't really matter. When I came here, I thought it was a big deal that I was a heroin addict. And so if you smoke Lenos or PCP or you smoke that organic non-addictive marijuana that God put here, or if you drank your drug, or if you was a prankster, like I really couldn't figure out the pranksters, man. You know, you got, you know, what the fuck was that all about, man? I'm gonna say that you hanging out talking to the guy bouncing off the show. As a heroin addict, we had our whole little thing, man. You know, we walk slow. You know, we kind of talk slow. We had a deep voice. You know, we was kind of laid back. What's up, man? How you doing, brother? Yeah, how you feel, man? Yeah, right on. I got it. Yeah, cool. We had that in our voice. And that's how I identified. When I came into the program, you know, I needed to see somebody like me, to use like me. You either had to look like me or use like me. So in the beginning, could no woman tell me nothing? Could no prankster tell me nothing? Could no hippie, LSD user, tell me nothing. I gravitated towards either the people, the men of color, or the men who use like I use. And I want to tell you, I'm saying this because I've learned over the years that it's not the messenger, it's the message. And that whole dynamic that we have, where we think that you got to be like me to help me, is one of the things that keeps us separated from each other. We don't care what your drug was. You don't have to say you're an addict. Our clarity statement speaks to that a little bit about you don't have to say you're an alcoholic or an addict, or you don't have to say what your drug of choice was. Once you say you're an addict, it's all inclusive. You know, if you say you're a peach, you don't also have to say you're a fruit. If you say you're a peach, we already know you're a fruit. So you don't have to double that up, you know. So the two things that I want to clarify about this is, one is that, you know, it's not important what we use. You know, what we use, our problem ain't really the drug anyway. Our problem is that we like to get high, and once we give ourselves permission to get high, we're in trouble. So once you tell yourself it's okay that you can get high, moderation is not our strong suit. So we don't tend to do anything in moderation well. So you can anything we like, we intend to do in excess. You know, we got a driver's license. You know, now we got three cars. A lot of us didn't work at all. Now you working two jobs. Didn't have no girlfriend. Now you got three girlfriends. You put down the spoon, you picked up the fork. You know, you gained like 100 pounds. You know, you stop smoking weed, now you start smoking cigarettes. You're smoking 2 and 3 packs of cigarettes. We just accept it. We got a credit card. Lord have mercy, some of us had no business getting credit cards. So we got a credit card, now we charging everything, you know. And so we tend to be excessive. Our problem ain't the drug. Our problem is that we like to fix. We like to use. You know, and we can use most anything. And so that's the one part of it. And the second part of it is this idea that, like I said, when I got here, I needed to see somebody that, like me, I thought only guys like me could help me. So when I went through treatment in handcuffs, there was like 40 guys in the program. There was only 2 other black guys in the program. There was about 3 other heroin addicts in the program. And so we hung together. And we hung together and lied all day and talked shit all day. 3, 5, or 6 knuckleheads lying all day about all the Cadillac doors we were slamming and all the penthouses we was living in and all the kilos we was transporting cross country. You know, and we just lying up a storm. Ain't none of us wasn't about shit. We was all little wound up, petty, trifling, scandalous, scurvy, dope thing. And, you know, I had a realization after about 9 months clean. I had a buddy who was a hippie from Oregon. And his name was Dean. Dean O. He was a grower in Oregon, heroin addict, and but we had very little in common. And one day I realized that Dean had to go to court, and I realized that I said to him, I was looking across the table, and I said, "Man, I hope this works out for you. You know, I hope, because they could have given him a lot of time, and he was a good dude, and I didn't want to see him go to prison." And I said, "Man, I hope this works out for you." And it dawned on me that I cared about another person. And I wound up, I genuinely loved this dude. And me and him had not very much in common. We had totally, he didn't fit into that thing that I thought I needed to connect with. And I realized that that I had a chance. Because that part of me that I thought was shut down and broken wasn't really shut down and broken. And I really had the capacity to care about another person. And I had to think past what a person looked like, what they used, what our background was, but see him as a brother in recovery. And I'm glad that I had that experience early on. I learned early on, 9 months, 10 months clean, that it wasn't about the messenger. It was about the message. It wasn't about, you know, what you look like and what you use and what race you was and what clique you was with or what part of the, whether you was from the north or the south or, you know, where we would be hanging out if we was in the penitentiary. None of that mattered. It was about you was my brother in recovery. And a lot of us wind up having to recover from that stuff. We recover from racism. We recover from this hierarchy around drugs, that one addiction is cooler than the other addiction. And we get somebody coming here whose drug of choice was maybe prescription medication, and we treat him like he's a punk because he never stuck a needle in his arm. Or he ain't got no tattoo. Oh, you soft, man. You ain't no dope thing. You a hope thing. You know, you are a wannabe, you know. And then the guy who had never been to the penitentiary ain't got no tattoos, ain't got no motorcycle, ain't no gangster, ain't never had a pistol. We make him feel like he don't belong in this program. And I think we do ourselves a disservice, you know, because it ain't the messenger, it's the message. I had a young girl tell my story, young white girl from Santa Cruz. Told my story. I'm a player from Chicago. I have a young white girl told my story, talking about looking in the mirror and seeing somebody she was ashamed of, seeing somebody she was disgusted with, walking across the street so she didn't have to, people didn't have to see what she had become. This girl's like 21 years old. And I was like, yeah, I get that. And I realized, man, that I needed to open my heart up, man. You know, that I wasn't all that. My story wasn't that unique. You know, so I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for the fact that's another thing that we probably don't talk about as much. And I was in London a little while ago, and I was going to an NA meeting with a buddy of mine in London, and I went to this meeting, and the guys in that meeting, there's a men's meeting also. The guys in that meeting, man, welcomed me like I was their long-lost son. You know, they opened their arms to me. Everybody came up and said hello. You know, we talk a lot about, and I guess I say that to say, do we do that as a fellowship? You know, do we really believe that the newcomer is the most important person in the room, or is that just a cool thing to say? This meeting has a good feeling to it because I was watching when people were standing up and getting there, doing the countdown, and you could see men standing up being proud to have the time that they had. And you could see the genuine applause, you know, like we were proud to have you have that time, you know. And that's one of the things that keeps this fellowship going, you know, having us feel welcoming to each other and all-inclusive and feel a part of. I wrote a story. A friend of mine asked me, you know, they're redoing the basic text. And maybe I'll tell you guys the story that I submitted. So, but they're redoing the basic text. My best friend is a biker from New York who I went through treatment with. Is my little brother. He's from the Bronx. The white guy, tattooed, biker, who's a Muslim, who married a girl from Fiji and turned into a Muslim. So he's the only white biker Muslim in the world, I'm guessing, you know. But that's my dog, though, man. That's my dog. He was the best man at my wedding. I was the best man at his wedding. Our kids are the same age. He got loaded after 12 years. We did recovery on the buddy plan. He got loaded after 12 years behind prescription medication. So maybe I'll say something quick about that before I talk about the book. You know, there's a lot of people in the program who are going to have to take the medication one day. As a matter of fact, it ain't even about what to do if you have to take medication. It's about what to do when you have to take medication. And that's another thing that we ain't talking about. There's people in here that probably need to be on antidepressants or other drugs like that, but I'm talking about pain medication. Because I've seen people with 5, 10, 15, 20 years get loaded behind a legitimate reason to take narcotics. That they get a root canal, that they have a back injury, that they have something like that. Now, somebody in here probably really needs to hear this, and if it ain't today you need to hear it, you're going to need to remember this somewhere down the line. Pain is just as much a threat to your recovery as pain medication. And so how we do that, or I ain't taking pain medication. I'm not saying this to cover up something I'm doing. I'm just telling you because I've seen it happen. I watched my buddy get a kidney stone, and the doctors gave him some Vicodin, which is heroin, which is good dope. And he didn't, first of all, ask for a doctor that understood addiction. He didn't tell his doctor that he was an addict. So this is what you got to do. You got to find a doctor who understands addiction. Tell the doctor you're an addict. Ask the doctor, is there a non-narcotic alternative to what you're taking? Call your, if you have to take it, call your sponsor. Call all the men in your support group. Say, man, they're getting ready to give me some Vicodin. Don't let them give you no prescription for 90 pills with 3 refills. You know, get one for, you know, for just a week at a time. And tell everybody, look, dog, I'm going to call you every day, man, because I'm taking these pills. And call. And tell your sponsor and stuff. You know, if it says you can take 4 a day, don't take all 4 of them at the same time. You know, when the prescription is over, throw that shit away and come to meetings and talk about it every day. I had to take these pills again today because the pain is so bad. And you can do that and get through it without having to be a relapse. But I've seen people be on this stuff and scared that if they say something about it, people are going to say they're using, so they ain't saying nothing, so they're doing it in secrecy, and now they're taking 3 and 4 at a time, and now they don't know if they're medicating the pain or the taking it just because they got a legal reason to take it, and they get loaded. So we've seen a whole bunch of people get loaded, people with a lot of clean time. A lot of clean time that wakes up just because you ain't using. Don't think, how many people believe in a higher power? If you believe in a higher power, believe in a lower power. If you think there's a higher power, also consider the likelihood that there's a lower power. And that low, just like the higher power has emissaries or people, you know, God, coincidences of God's way of remaining anonymous. Well, that lower power does the same kind of stuff. It'll serve symptom folks out there, and they say God talks to people. Well, that lower power talks to people too, and it's just, there's people out there trying to get you as you move forward. There's people trying to get you to come back to the other side, and just like there's a higher self in you, there's a lower self in you. So the addict part of us ain't never checked out. Don't underestimate. Don't overestimate your recovery and underestimate your disease. The addict part of us is alive and well at all times. And clean time is not a good barometer by which to gauge the quality of your recovery. Just because somebody got 20 years or 30 years don't mean that they got more recovery than somebody with 30 months. Recovery ain't how much time you got. Recovery is how you live in your life. And at any given day, my recovery might be A on one day and a C minus on another day. Because it ain't what you do at the meetings, it's what you do the other 22 and a half hours a day. That's what real recovery is about. And I've seen people with 6 months be full of recovery. And people with 6 years, sick as can be, acting out all over the place. You know, I've had 10, 15, 20 years and been shady. Doing some shit I know I got no business doing. Sometimes I'm like all over my recovery, and sometimes I just ain't using. You know, so don't think just because somebody got a lot of time means that they in a lot of recovery. You know, so, my buddy got loaded after 12 years. He just celebrated 7 years just recently on the day after Thanksgiving. But anyway, they, when they were doing that book, they are doing a new edition of the basic text. And he asked me, he said, man, you need to write a story for that. Because they're asking for people to write stories. So I wrote a story and sent it into NA World Service. And it looks like it's going to be in the next basic text. And so they sent me a copy of it. So I'm going to tell you the story that I wrote for it. And if it comes out in the book, you can say, man, I got that story right there. I heard that dude tell that story one day at the men's breakfast. It might not come out, you know, who knows. But if it don't come out, it's a good story because it's one of the things that, it was one of them, you know, one of them times where my higher power reminded me that he had my back. You know, because sometimes you get it, this recovery thing is hard. This ain't the easiest, softer way. To do the right thing, to do the next right thing. Sometimes, man, I just want to put on some leather pants, smoke cigarettes, and hit the highway. You know, I want to call it a while. You know, that, oh! You know, all of a sudden, I feel like a square. I've been clean and I'm gonna turn into a lop. I got a lunchbox, you know, and I wanna fuck that. I'm an outlaw too. Shit, I wanna go and be bad and stuff. I'm tired of showing up for work. I'm tired of sitting there and be doing the right thing. And this punk, he don't even know who I am talking to me like that. I'll kick his ass. You know, I want to go to that place, you know. But now I got to do the next right thing. So, yeah, man, okay. No, I feel you, man. You know, it's all right. You know. It's okay. It's cool. No, I understand. I'm going to walk away from this. You know, I got to be good. You know, I got to wake up and go to work. Sometimes I don't want to go to work. Fuck work. Shit. You know, I want to take stuff. You know, sometimes I want to punch somebody in the eye. You know, just on general principle, because I ain't punched somebody in the eye in a long time. So, you know, but it's hard to be in recovery all the time. You know, you got to parent a different kind of way. Those of you got kids, you know, when you was a kid, these kids get away with all kinds of stuff. You know, when we was a kid, man, we used to get knocked out. You know, now we trying to talk to our kids. Okay, son, you little punk, I'll bust you in the head. You know, so we got to do the right thing. We don't want to have to write about it or make amends. We're trying to live the right life. And sometimes that gets rough, man. And you feel stuff. You know, in recovery, you start feeling stuff. You was using, you didn't feel nothing. You had no conscience. Did what you wanted to do. Now in recovery, you feel all this pleasure, but you also feel all this pain. You know, and so sometimes you want to shut that off. And so this is a rough road. This is a rough road to hope. But I'm so glad I'm doing it, man. I wouldn't want to, like I said, that the reason that I stay clean is because I ain't willing to pick up the tab to use again. Because I recognize no matter how good using felt, well, I ain't got no veins anyway. So if I wanted to go back to using, I'd only probably have about 3 or 4 days before the few veins that they kind of will pop up for a little bit will collapse again. And then I'm going in the neck. And I ain't really looking forward to going in the neck. You know, that's the progression, y'all know. It's the arms, the hands, the feet, and then the neck. And then you go, if you have to do like that to go in the neck. That shit ain't cool, you know. And by then, your hands all swole up, and you can't walk because your feet are hurting, and you're in the neck. Now you got tracks on. Anyway. So the price for me is if I use, I have to give the dope man the keys to my cars, to my Mercedes, plural, to my house, to my offices, my career, my wife, my sons. I got to give him my self-esteem, my dignity, my self-respect, my relationship with my higher power. I got to give him all my friends. I got to give him my courage and my self-esteem. I got to give him my spiritual connection. I got to give him all this little jewelry, that little leather jacket. And $100. And say, give me a hit. Because that's what it costs now. I ain't got no illusion that it just costs $100. See, when I go, all of it goes. Everything that we got will fit in the pipe or in the cooker or in the shot glass or whatever you was doing. We can smoke, shoot it all up just like that. You know, and be ass out. So I know that that's the price, and I just ain't willing to pay that price no more. There was a time where I was willing to pay it, but now I just ain't willing to pay it. I ain't willing to give my wife up. I ain't willing to give up being a father. You know, one of the biggest gifts for me, man, was being able to be a dad, being present in my kids' life. And I tell you that the reason that I got clean, they say that you can't get clean for your woman or for your job or for the courts or for your, you know, you got to get clean for you. That's bullshit. It ain't no wrong reason to do the right thing. Whatever reason got you here is the right reason. Didn't nobody sit at the house with a whole bunch of dope having big fun and say, you know what, tomorrow I'm going to NA. I'm going to quit using. I'm giving all this up, and tomorrow I'm start going to meetings. That ain't what happens. Everybody comes into a recovery with a foot in their ass from somewhere. You know, and so that's how I got clean. I got clean to be going to the penitentiary. And I got clean because I realized that if I didn't get clean, my 3-year-old son didn't have a chance. And I couldn't do it to that boy. I didn't care if I died, but I couldn't do it to him. I had this moment of clarity where I realized that if he's going to make it, I need to be clean. And I got clean for my son. My son's 24 years old right now. He probably saved up last year about $80,000. He fixed his helicopters. He went to Iraq, went to the military, got out as a civilian, and he fixed his helicopters. He's been in Hawaii. His job sent him to Hawaii, to Alaska, and pretty soon he's going to Afghanistan to be on a civilian base in Afghanistan. And in 11 months, he's going to make $130,000. He's 24 years old. Sharp young man. I got a 15-year-old son who's bigger than me. 15, he's 6'6". Wears a size 17 shoe. Shoulders out to here. And he's a baby. He's my baby boy. And I love him. And my kids today, when they look back on their childhood, they will know that their daddy loved them. That their dad had their back. That I believed in them. I hug them and I kiss them and I talk to them. And I spend time with them, and I travel with them, and I live with them. I raise them, and I taught them how to drive. I teach them how to tie a tie. I play video games with them. And they will look back on their childhood, and they will know that. I was never able to do that. So that's a blessing. I ain't willing to give that up. I got a wife who loves my dirty drawers. My wife told me for Christmas. I said, baby, what do you want for Christmas? She said, I just want you to go somewhere. You know, because I take trips by myself. I get away. The other way, I went to Costa Rica. I went to Argentina. I went to Costa Rica and rented a four-wheel drive and drove all around the country all by myself. Had no agenda whatsoever. Stopped wherever I wanted, swam, hung out with the local people, practiced the language, went to Buenos Aires in Argentina, went to London. My wife says, go do your thing. You know, That's all. So she's, you know, I love my wife, man, and I'm grateful, you know, to be. I got a career. You know, I got clean, and 6 months after I got clean, I started working in the field. Since I've been working in the field, I've written books. I have opened programs. I run a program right now in Marin County where we treat movie stars and NFL players, and, you know, I designed it. I'm the director of it. I started at a hospital as a counselor in 1989. 9 years later, I was the director of the whole department, ran the whole facility. I do 3 relapse prevention groups in San Francisco with physicians that are addicted. So I got doctors and lawyers that are clients, probably 40-something of them. You know, I ain't saying that to brag. I'm saying that to say that, you know, we don't even know where our lives are going to go. You know, I lived in a shooting gallery. The last residence I had when I was using, I never worked at all. I had no degrees, no nothing. I got master's degrees now. I had a master's degree. I got all of the addiction certifications. I teach addiction studies. I was just in Lemoore teaching the whole Kings County alcohol and drug providers. How to work with addicts and alcoholics. That's what I do. And I'm a dope fiend. I did all that. I got on the mission in recovery. See, if you get on the mission in recovery, see, they can't stop us. We're in demand. An addict, a man, recovering addict, clean. Man, we know some shit that they don't even teach in Harvard Business School. We've got the resilience, the perseverance. You know, we not know how to go to any length, right? How many people, we know how to go to any length, right? We're creative, right? We're resourceful, right? We know how to be humble, right? Y'all know how to be humble. What you mean? How many of y'all begged the dope man for it? Shit. Come on, dog. Come on, man. I'll pay you tomorrow. Come on. How many of y'all ever had your head in the toilet stool? It's humble. How many of you ever stood in front of the judge and tried to look as pitiful as possible so they catch you some slack? See, we know how to be humble. We got faith, right? How many people got faith? We always have faith. We turned our will and our life over to a power greater than ourselves years before we got here. You know, you turned your will and your life over to cocaine, over to heroin, over to the lifestyle. So we know how to do that. We had faith. Anytime you ever, how many people ever bought dope from somebody you didn't know? That's faith. And took it, shot it, smoked it, dropped it, and said, well, I hope this is good. This guy, you ain't never met this guy your whole life. You just gave him $100 and took whatever it was he gave. So we got it with the courage. We got the courage that it took you to come and to show up and to raise your hand and talk. That's all the courage you'll ever need. So we've got the skill set. We know how to convince people to support us. How many of y'all ever convinced somebody? How many of y'all ever got loaded for weeks at a time and was broke? I said, we know how to talk people into coming on board. Come on over here and work with me here. So all that stuff, if you put that into some recovery deal, they can't stop us. They can't stop us. Ain't no telling where you're going to wind up. So here's this story, and I'm going to shut up. So I came from Chicago with a buddy of mine. It was cold as fuck in Chicago. It was about 2 degrees. And they had what they had, a big snow. They call it a big snow. That's when the snow gets above 6 feet. And so this was one of them big snows. We was, me and my buddy Barry was living in a basement apartment. That's your name, right, Barry? Me and my buddy Barry was living in a basement apartment. This is my homeboy, man. We grew up together. He lived on, his mom didn't like me hanging out with him because I was, we looked like brothers except I was the rough version of him. Kind of, he was all neat and I was all wild. And anyway, long story short, it was really cold. I said, man, I was watching TV. We had our little bachelor pad, you know, with the mattresses on the floor and the Jimi Hendrix black light posters and the fishnets hanging up. Remember that? We used to cut the weed up in the dust cover from the record player, where you take the weed and you shake it in there, and you had the album cover and all that. So we were drinking Wild Irish Rose and Night Train and Mad Dog 2020, drinking cough syrup. Oh man, that was the day. And so I was looking at TV and they showed a picture of California. They had this girl in this convertible and they had palm trees and at the beach. And I looked out the window and it was a big snow, 2 degrees. I said, man, fuck that, I'm going to California. And he said, well, I'm going too. We sold our apartment to a friend of ours named Paul for $400. He could have everything that was in the apartment, albums, black light posters, everything. And we caught the Greyhound bus and moved to California. Wound up in San Francisco. My addiction flourished. My addiction took off. Barry got into kind of a square, slower paced lifestyle. Started going to San Francisco State, got him a little square girlfriend. I started hanging out with hoes and bank robbers and stick up guys and shit, you know, and we went kind of two separate ways, but that was my homeboy, so we would always kind of come together and hang out. He would sneak and find me to use. So he was one of them undercover addicts. He looked like a square, but he was really a straight dope fiend. So one night he came to get me. I was at a nightclub in San Francisco, coincidentally named Roland's. And he came and found me, and he wanted to get high. And Barry couldn't hit himself. And so we went and copped. And at that time they had supposed to be China White heroin out. But it was really fentanyl. Now, I had shot China White in Harlem, in Hawaii, in Amsterdam, in Germany. I knew what China White was. I knew this wasn't really China White. But the word was out that this dope was killing people. And so I wanted to get some. You know, because they got this, you know, that's how it was. They got this OD dope. You know, man, folks OD'ing on this shit. This shit's off the hook. I said, who got it? And so there's an African dude that had it, who I actually just saw about last year. When we was at the World Convention in Hawaii, I was at the beach and this dude walked up, was selling weed. The same dude that showed me this dope years ago. So anyway, I went to the African, bought me some China White, and me and Barry went back to this hotel that I was living in the tender on the Mission District, on the El Dorado Hotel on 9th and Mission. And we went to the hotel, it's a dope fiend hotel, pissing the hallway hotel, and we both fixed. I fixed him because he couldn't hit himself, and I fixed me. And we both overdosed. I woke up, and Barry didn't wake up. And when I woke up, I came to, and he was laying on the bed, and he was out. And I tried to shake him, and he wouldn't wake up. And so I tried to carry him like they do on TV, but I couldn't do it because it's harder than it looks. So I wound up having to drag him down the hall into the lobby of this hotel, Dauphine Hotel. I asked the Hindu to call the ambulance. And to this day, I can't stand curry. The smell of curry, it reminds me of my youth, because all them hotels that we used to use in, the Hindus owned them, and they'd be cooking curry all the time, and I just hate that smell. But this dude was so cool. The guy that ran the thing, his name was Sonny. Sundap was his real name. But I said, Sonny, call the ambulance, man. And so he called the ambulance. The ambulance came with the police. And so the cops looked at us, two black dope fiends. Said, what the fuck? You know, it's like taking out the garbage to them. And they said, what you want to do? And they said, we're going to take him to San Francisco General. They said, you want to come? I said, I'll be there in a minute. I went back to the room and I fixed again. The problem of this disease. I overdosed again. I wake up about 5 o'clock, 5 hours later, 3 hours later, and I think, oh shit, where's Barry? I gotta go to the hospital and pick Barry up. I go to the hospital, I get on the phone from the lobby, and they tell me Barry, that he died, that he was dead. And I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. It's my dog, man. It's my brother, man. He's dead. I gave him the injection. So I call this little square girlfriend. It's about 6 o'clock in the morning. As soon as she hear my voice, she screams. She don't even hear any words. I just said, Patty. And she, no! Fuck me up. And she's screaming. And she knew. Women know that kind of stuff. She knew that something was bad. Something had happened. It was with me. Nobody liked him hanging out with me because I was the bad one. And so they had his funeral. My son was about 2 at that time. And I went to the funeral late, and I was holding my son in my arms, and his mom, when I walked in, everybody turned around and looked at me like, you got a lot of nerve coming here. That's who I was. You could imagine that. Everybody just turned and looked around and was like, fuck, Sam, he's here. Look at this. You got the nerve to be here. And I felt fucked up. And I walked up to Barry's mom, and I was getting ready to say something. Mrs. C, I'm sorry. And she looked at me with disgust on her face, and she said, look at my son. And she said, well, at least you still have your son. And she walked away. And my using got real suicidal after that. I just didn't care no more. I felt so bad. I was so tore up, and I loved this dude, man. He was like the brother. I never had a brother. You guys were my brothers now, but before that, I never had no brothers. And I was tore up. And eventually I wound up getting clean, but that was the end of my using. When I had 2 years clean, I was doing an inventory. I went back to Chicago to write a letter to my mom, because I was so caught up in my disease that when my mom died, I didn't even go to her funeral. But I was so full of resentment. She was in an unmarked grave for years. I just put a gravestone on her grave about 12 years ago. I realized I needed to make amends to my mom. I went to Chicago to write a letter to my mom to read at her gravesite. Chicago has this beach. The east side of Chicago is all beach. There's this one little patch of beach in my neighborhood that's about less than a half a mile long of maybe 40 miles of beach. It's called The Point. And I used to go to The Point. All of us used to go to The Point as a kid. And we smoke weed and play bongos and hang out and stuff, and it was like a little area. So I went to The Point to write this note, this letter. And for the first time, I had about 2 years clean, 2.5 years clean. For the first time in my recovery, I felt serene. I had never had no serenity. I couldn't stand to be by myself because my head would just be talking to me all the time, telling me what a piece of shit I was and how come I don't just use. But this day, I was like washed in serenity. You know, and I wrote this letter to my mom, and I just felt that I swam in the water, and I left. And when I left, I started driving, and I realized that I was about 5 minutes from Barry's mom's house. And I said, well, shoot, I'm gonna go over to Barry's mom's house and tell her that I'm in recovery, that I'm clean. And so I went over there, and I knocked on the door, rang the doorbell, and nobody answered. So I went and took one of my business cards, and I wrote on there, Dear Mrs. Chapman, just want you to know that I've been clean for over 2 years. I work helping other people get clean and sober. I'm really sorry about what happened to Barry. I miss him a lot. God bless you. Love, Roland. And I dropped it through the mail slot, and it fell in a little hallway part. And I got back to the car, and the dude opened the door and said, hey, you looking for Mrs. Chapman? I said, yes. He said, well, come on in. She's upstairs. he was her new husband. He didn't know who I was. And so he invited me into her house and told me to have a seat on the couch. And so I had a seat on the couch, and about 3 minutes later, Mrs. Chapman walked in. She's a very educated, proper lady, and she walked in and she saw me, and she didn't know what to do because I'm sitting in her house. And she's looking at me like, what are you doing here? And he handed her the card, and when he handed her the card, she started reading it, and she broke down in tears and started crying. And then she opened her arms to me. And I got up and gave her a hug, and she held me, and she sobbed, and then I start crying. And so I hadn't been able to cry at that point. So we're both sobbing and sobbing. And she asked me, she said, did Barry know we loved him? Did Barry feel loved? Did he understand how valuable he was to us? Because he was adopted just like me. And I said, yeah, he loves you guys. He knew you guys loved him, and he, you know, and you guys were great. And then she told me that they always knew. They always blamed me for Barry's stuff, but they knew that Barry had that in him. And it was easier for them to blame me than, but she said, we knew it was Barry's own way, that it wasn't you making him do stuff, you know. And she set me free of my guilt, and I set her free of her guilt. And she took me down in the basement, and we went through all these pictures, and she gave me pictures of Barry when he was young, and we talked and laughed, and she told me her story. And she said, before you leave Chicago, she said, go to the point, because that's where we scattered Barry's ashes. And I said, I've been to the point all day. Look, my hair was still all curly from swimming. That's where I was all day before I came over here. And I knew. I knew that my higher power had worked in my life. My sponsor calls it an example of God showing off. You know, I knew that my higher power had directed that whole scene. And so I'm gonna close with that. You know, like no matter how bad you think you got, no matter that there's a way out, no matter how deep you think you got into your disease, that this program can provide you with another way. You know, I've had the same sponsor since I've been clean. I only have one sponsor. I got the same sponsor today that I had when I got clean. This guy told me early on, he said, and I'm going to say this to you, he said, man, I love you no matter what. And so I love you no matter what. I don't need you to be okay. This is a place where it's okay to not be okay. You know, and I'm so glad to be a member of Narcotics Anonymous. I'm so glad to be clean. And I'm so glad that you guys had me here this morning. Thank you, and God bless you.